As always, the opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.
If the leadership in Beijing has decided that, you know, conflict with the United States is at greater and greater risk, talk about flashpoints like Taiwan, South China Sea, maybe they have concluded that imitation of the U.S. strategy is logical, that conflict may happen and our ability to launch first, if we think that's going to happen, would save a lot of Chinese lives. The problem with that is that makes a crisis between China and the U.S. incredibly unstable, because both sides now have the capability and possibly the intent to launch first.
Aloha and welcome to Dialogue, where conversations shape security. I'm your host, James Minnick, Colonel United States Army retired and professor here at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies in Honolulu, Hawaii. This is episode 42, China's Nuclear Rise. Since the dawn of the nuclear age, the world has lived with the paradox of weapons so destructive that their primary utility lies in never being used. The logic of strategic deterrence, anchored in the principle of mutual assured destruction, has shaped decades of military doctrine, diplomacy, and crisis management. And for much of the post-Cold War period, that logic appeared durable, with major nuclear powers downsizing their arsenal and fears of superpower confrontation fading. But we're no longer in that world. Today, the global nuclear landscape is entering a period of profound transformation, technologically, geopolitically, and psychologically. Nowhere is this shift more evident than in the case of the People's Republic of China. For decades, China maintained a relatively modest nuclear force under the doctrine of minimum deterrence, focused on ensuring a second strike capability. But in 2021, that assumption was shaken when satellite imagery revealed the construction of more than 300 new missile silos in China's western deserts. By 2024, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute estimated that China's arsenal had reached around 500 warheads and projected that it could double to 1,000 by 2030. This development raises difficult and urgent questions. Why now? What strategic objectives is Beijing pursuing? And how should the United States and its allies respond? Understanding China's motivations isn't easy. China remains opaque about its intentions. Some argue this buildup is aimed at preserving second strike credibility, while others suggest Beijing seeks greater strategic leverage, believing that a larger arsenal will enhance its bargaining power or deter American intervention in regional conflicts. What is clear is this: China is acquiring capabilities that go far beyond what required for minimum deterrence. The door to more dangerous, less stable deterrence models is opening. And this transformation is unfolding amid deteriorating trust, rising strategic competition, and growing flashpoints across East Asia, from the Taiwan Straits to the South China Sea. Yet the complexity runs deeper. Some may argue that the answer is simple: match China warhead for warhead as its arsenal grows. But that logic assumes we're in a race to outnumber, a return to Cold War-styled thinking that may not be suited to today's multipolar world. Deterrence is not just a numbers game. It's also about survivability, credibility, and communication. It's about ensuring no adversary believes a nuclear exchange can be won or survived. Which brings us to another urgent concern: the risk of inadvertent escalation. In a world of dual-use platforms, cyber threats, and ambiguous signaling, the fire breaks between conventional and nuclear conflict is growing thinner. China's nuclear expansion demands attention, nuance, and discipline. Because if the 20th century taught us anything, it is that the nuclear realm certainly is elusive, but consequences are final. To help us unpack this issue, I'm joined today by Dr. Bill Wininger, a retired U.S. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel and a professor at DKI APCSS. Bill specializes in weapons of mass destruction, deterrence, and missile defense. He's the author of a timely and thought-provoking chapter titled Balancing Act, shaping U.S. policy in the face of China's nuclear expansion. Bill Wininger, welcome to Dialogue.
Thanks, James. Delighted to be here.
Yeah, super glad to have you here. You and I talk all the time, and I've talked about having you on this program. Sorry it's taken so long, but this is going to be a fantastic discussion that I've been looking forward to.
Me too.
I wonder if you might start by just sharing a little bit about your story. How'd you come to become an expert in this field?
Well, I think I was destined to it because I started out in 1993 as an officer in the U.S. Air Force, and my idea was to become a fighter pilot. But at that time, the only job open to me was maintenance on ICBMs. So I joined in 1993, went to F.E. Warren, where I was maintenance officer on the Minuteman III and the Peacekeeper weapon system, which we no longer have. I wanted to get out of that as quickly as I could because it's, those northern bases are cold and the mission is actually really boring. You don't want a lot of creative thinking around nuclear weapons. So I managed to get the Air Force to send me out to Guam to be a pole mill officer, which I did. But I ended up getting back to nuclear weapons when I went to grad school. My initial dissertation was supposed to be on civil-military relations in Indonesia, and I had done a lot of field work on that. And then the Bali bombing occurred in 2002, which meant I could not return to Indonesia for my field research. So my advisor and I decided I would write my dissertation on the effectiveness of nuclear deterrence. There was a debate that's been well-known for a long time between Kenneth Waltz and Scott Sagan, about whether or not nuclear weapons proliferation is good. Waltz argues that it is good because rational actors will not risk nuclear war when two countries have nuclear weapons. And Scott Sagan says that Waltz is wrong or we shouldn't trust proliferation because accidents happen. And I thought this didn't really test Waltz's key contention, which is that rationality means nuclear war can't happen. So I set out to examine that, and I wrote my dissertation in 2004. On this question, ultimately concluding that nuclear weapons possession, mutual nuclear weapons possession by two states, does definitely reduce the risk of war, but it does not eliminate the possibility. And so we really need to think about how to navigate that space, and that's why I'm delighted to be here talking with you about today.
That's fascinating. I'm sorry you had to have a trajectory on your dissertation. That was probably a painful conversation to have.
It wasn't easy. It took me an extra few months in grad school, but I'm glad it worked out that way.
Yeah, no, without a doubt. Well, you and I certainly crossed over a little bit in spending time in the nuclear arena, as it were. Though my focus, I guess by the time you started that, I had left tactical nuclear weapons and you had gone into the strategic ones at the silos and stuff. Well, maybe we'll bring up some of that as we talk. I wonder, maybe we'll just go ahead and begin the conversation. The first thought I had to talk about is China's nuclear expansion. I mean, it's rapidly expanding its nuclear arsenal. Recent estimates show that by 2030, which is just a few more years away, that they could double their arsenal to 1,000 warheads. So the question is this: what are the key drivers that are building this, that are behind this buildup, and what does it reveal about China's evolving nuclear strategy and global ambitions? What do you see?
That's a really important question, and I think it's a hard one to be certain of the answer, but we can be certain of some possibilities, right? So the Chinese leadership are pretty clearly not open and transparent, and Chinese strategic culture is not about being open and transparent. It's about kind of hiding and biding. So China for decades had couple dozen weapons capable of hitting the United States, presumably holding 10, 20 cities at risk, and they felt that was enough. And then they started to gradually increase that arsenal in the late 90s. And you could, at that time, I think, speculate that it had to do with nascent developments in U.S. missile defense. As I mentioned in my chapter that you, in the book you mentioned, unfortunately, in the mid-90s, there was a point at which a reporter asked a senior U.S. government official, like, how many nuclear warheads does this missile defense system need to be able to stop, and his response was about 20. 20 was a bit high for a rogue nation, but it was about right for the PRC. And so, as they introduced their DF-31 and started moving down that path, I was quite confident that that was primarily the driver, was that they want to be able to overcome missile defense. Because, after all, if you're a national security, nuclear planner, you don't just have to be able to hit enemy targets, you have to be able to ride out that first wave for that. If you don't have second strike capability, that's not good. So nations need to build that second strike capability. And in the 90s, the Chinese arsenal was a little bit vulnerable to a first strike. And then you combine that with nascent missile defense, and you have a situation perhaps where they can't get through. Fast forward to 2020s now, we see a dramatic increase in the arsenal. And so the question you ask is, why is that? It could still be related to missile defense, because our missile defense systems have continued to get better and perform better and better than many of us expected. In fact, I read a good piece recently that highlighted one of the mistakes that critics of missile defense made was focusing on speed and not sensing. And so what we've seen happen in the most recent years is, with advances in computational sensing, AI, et cetera, the ability to predict the path of a very fast-moving vehicle has increased, hence our ability to intercept has increased. But there are alternative explanations for China's decision to increase its arsenal. Tang Zhao, who's a scholar at the Carnegie Institute, has written a lot about this, and his argument is that this is driven primarily by a perception in Beijing that nuclear arsenal give you bargaining strength in international crises. He may have come to that, or the Beijing may well be thinking that, like, we need to increase our arsenal. The US and China are in this competition, and we need to have strength, because right now the US has asymmetry. And there's a prominent US scholar named Matt Kronig, who has published a book, The Logic of American Nuclear Strategy, makes a very strong case that asymmetry has given the United States advantage in crises and in international bargaining. Now, there are scholars who disagree with some of his findings, and I happen to be one of them, but it's definitely possible that the Chinese have read his book, seen his stature, and thought, maybe we need to do this too. Third possibility is the most disconcerting one to me, which is the possibility that the PRC has decided to embark upon a damage mitigation launch on warning posture. We don't talk about this a lot publicly in the United States, but the reality is that our current nuclear force posture is perfectly structured for damage mitigation, which is the idea that the president gets very strong intelligence indications that an attack is imminent, and he would therefore be able to launch some of our very rapid response, accurate weapon systems, the Minuteman III I used to work on, and take out as many of the enemy's nuclear weapons before they launch as possible, therefore minimizing the amount of damage the United States suffers in that conflict that the president has come to believe is inevitable. If the leadership in Beijing has decided that, you know, conflict with the United States is at greater and greater risk, we talk about flashpoints like Taiwan, South China Sea, maybe they have concluded that imitation of the U.S. strategy is logical, that conflict may happen and our ability to launch first, if we think that's going to happen, would save a lot of Chinese lives. The problem with that is that makes a crisis between China and the US incredibly unstable, because both sides now have the capability and possibly the intent to launch first.
That's very comprehensive and yet a little bit disquieting, I might offer. And so as you were talking, I kind of wondered, you know, we went through the Cold War, decades of trying to posture against the other side and try to understand them. And so let's talk about, you know, what are those lessons from the Cold War that we might be able to pull on here? Even before the show, you and I were talking about, I first started thinking coherently about this in school, you know, pulling clippings on the 1972 SALT treaties and then of course, you know, the anti-ballistic missile treaties and all those things that came out of that period. Are there lessons that from the Cold War that apply to the deterrence application today? And if so, what are they? And if not, what shortfalls are we considering here in this context?
So the shortfall we face right now is it's no longer a bilateral or bipolar world. We have Russia, China, and the United States, right? And so that multipolarity dynamic of major nuclear powers is new, and that introduces a little bit more uncertainty and instability into the mix. That I think we need more scholarship on. Lessons that I think we can draw from the Cold War are very clear. Have you heard of Exercise Able Archer?
Yes, of course.
Able Archer in 1983 was a U.S. command and control exercise in NATO that was designed at a period when the Cold War had gotten very cold again, early in the Reagan administration, to test NATO's nuclear command and control capacity in the face of a Russian invasion. And what we learned in the middle of this exercise was that the Russian spies were picking up on Able Archer in a way that was leading Russian leadership to believe it was actually the prelude to a sneak attack. And so the exercise was actually canceled midway through because of this concern. So what that tells you is how easy it is to misperceive things in this. And so you need to have a lot of communication between the two sides, which we don't have right now with the PRC. We need more communication. The other big lesson that I would draw attention to, and we can go into much more detail if you want, but I know we have other things to cover, would be the lesson of the Cuban Missile Crisis. In 1962, Robert S. McNamara was Secretary of Defense, and I've met Mr. McNamara, and he said very clearly in a documentary called 11 Lessons in War that we got lucky in 1962. It was luck that prevented nuclear war. And I asked him in person how he felt about that, and he was very adamant that we lucked out. One of the things that they didn't know in 1962, the U.S. intelligence community was assessing with high confidence that there were no nuclear weapons yet in Cuba. And in 1992 or 93, there was a meeting between the principals of the Cuban Missile Crisis at which McNamara learned that there were already over 100 nuclear weapons in Cuba. And he was just dumbfounded by this revelation because the United States came very close to attacking Cuba under the presumption there were no nuclear weapons there. But what it turns out is there were nuclear weapons there, and the local commanders had been pre-delegated authority in some circumstances to use them. And McNamara knew how close the U.S. came to attacking Cuba in mistaken belief there were no nuclear weapons there. So miscalculation definitely can happen, and it will be more likely to happen if there's less communication.
You know, in both your stories, I had to harken back on a few things. and it reminded me how not just this miscalculations, but this escalation of things that are going on. So in 1983, I was up in the Korean DMZ at a firebase. I was deployed up there. And I remember the night that the Korean airline flight 007 was shot down by the Soviets. And this is happening in 83, and there's, you know, how are we going to respond? But yet, you know, you've got Able Archer going on at the same time frame. You know, when I think back on the Cuban Missile Crisis, of course, you know, Graham Allison wrote a great book on it. But if I'm just going to go to contemporary pop culture, what was it, 13 Days?
Great movie.
Great movie, right? In that movie, they talked about how during those 13 days, the U.S. was conducting routine or scheduled, I guess is a better term, nuclear tests. I think it was part of Dominic series tests that were going on. And so we tested an underground nuclear test device. And so if you're the other side, you just, you know, you're questioning these actions that are happening, you know, whether they're posturing, and we got to move it up, and it's a dangerous place to operate.
Yeah, another thing that happened in the Cuban Missile Crisis was an overflight by U-2, which was routinely scheduled near the Soviet borders. The pilot went off course and flew into Soviet airspace, and he safely flew out, but certainly could look like the prelude to an attack. And so I think in 13 days, one of the characters says, you know, there's always some dumb person who doesn't get the message. And so, yeah, what would a local commander do? You know, another one during the Cuban Missile Crisis, there was a Soviet submarine on station that was being depth charged, not in an intent to sink the ship, but depth charged with light depth charges trying to force this diesel electric submarine to surface for hours.
Yes.
And the captain of the submarine had a nuclear torpedo and had decided to use it on an American destroyer. However, command and control in the Soviet Union required concurrence from two other officers, one of whom did not concur. And again, had that not happened and a nuclear torpedo had taken out a U.S. destroyer, then you can see where that might go.
Yeah, obviously. Well, let's talk a bit about second strike capability. A secure second strike capability, it's fundamental to deterrence, and yet China is rapidly modernizing its nuclear forces. And so here's the question. Does this indicate a shift in China's nuclear posture toward a launch on warning or a damage mitigation strategy, as you were just speaking about? What do you think?
So I think, I think it's important not to overreact, right? So a lot of people are talking about this increase in the Chinese arsenal in sort of very scared terms. And that we don't know the exact motivation for this, but overreaction would be the last thing we want to do, right? They are a peer competitor. They have a huge economy. They can choose to build as many nuclear weapons as they want. It's not up to us to decide how many they build, but it is up to us to ensure that we have secure second strike capability regardless of what they do, right? So my first response would be don't overreact. We got to make sure we have a second strike capability going forward, and we can talk more about what that might entail later. In terms of what the Chinese intention is, I think, as I said earlier, their form of governance makes it very difficult to have any certainty. They would definitely try and mislead us if they could on where they were going with this. I have a great deal of respect for Tang Xiao's scholarship and his knowledge of the Chinese system and so forth. So when he says it's more tied to strategic leverage and bargaining, I tend to go with his argument. But it doesn't really matter, because if they build this capability, they have launch on warning capability. They have damage mitigation capability. And so what I think we need to think about is how we can communicate with our, you know, our competitor in a way that reduces the risk of nuclear crises coming along. And so again, overreaction makes that worse. I saw a piece recently by a very well-respected American nuclear scholar, you know, saying, hey, we're underestimating how many weapons they have. They have a lot more. And the tone of the article is alarming, right? They've got a lot more, therefore we've got to do a lot more. And that's not really true. The key is that we have second strike capability. The Chinese have did a test of something called a fractional orbital bombardment system, or a FOBS. Not a new thing. The Soviets looked at it during the Cold War. We looked at it. Essentially, what a FOBS system gives you is the ability to penetrate missile defenses. The Soviets in the 60s decided that, you know, as the U.S. was considering building missile defense, they looked at the FOB and they decided, you know, this is an expensive way to address missile defense. Let's just build more missiles. And so maybe that's what the Chinese are doing too. Hypersonic weapons, again, it's to penetrate missile defenses. The reason we're not looking at FOBs, the reason we're not looking at hypersonics as strongly as Russia and the Chinese are, is because they don't have those kind of missile defense systems. So this gets to something that you and I hadn't talked about earlier, but I have to bring up, and it's a really unpleasant reality. Missile defense, the idea that we can defend ourselves from enemy attack, is obviously a logical thing to want to do. But nuclear weapons have made the world illogical in some ways. And so we can build a missile defense that'll probably be effective against a country like North Korea or Iran. They have limited resources. There are only so much they can do. Against a peer competitor, I don't think it's possible, because they can just keep putting more money into their own systems to overwhelm that missile defense system. During the Cold War, McNamara commissioned a study that found that for every $3 we spent on missile defense systems, the Soviets need only spend $1 to overcome that $3. So it's a losing proposition. Technology is different today, but it's different on both sides. And so, barring some unforeseen technical breakthrough, missile defense is, well, very attractive and very useful against somebody like Iran or North Korea, are not going to help us against Russia or China. And so we have to figure out how to navigate that space without creating an arms race in a destabilizing situation. One thing I worry about is mistakes again, right? So we build a missile defense system that we have a high degree of confidence in, and that gives us excessive risk-taking propensity because we think we have this defensive shield, which may not work.
I want to pull on several things you've talked about, but I think I want to do it going through this issue of, you know, contemporary, the Russia-Ukraine war and nuclear deterrence. You know, despite nuclear threats. Russia's refrained from using its nuclear weapons there in Ukraine, and though it's been discussed many times if they would. And of course, the war is not over. But what does this tell us about nuclear deterrence in practice, and how might China interpret these lessons?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Prior to the Ukraine war, I think many scholars, myself included, were very much worried about a conventional escalation to nuclear escalation, which then would be uncontrolled. And the lessons of the Ukraine war, I think, maybe give us some confidence that the threshold for nuclear use is harder to cross than we thought. I just reviewed the numbers today. As of late January, the best estimate I've seen from IISS is that 167,000 Russian soldiers have died in 3 years. 367,000 seriously wounded, like life-changing wounds. So they have suffered enormously. As you said, they've threatened the use of nuclear weapons, but they haven't done it. Ultimately, one thing that many people aren't aware of is that sort of battlefield nuclear weapons they're really problematic to use. You think of nuclear detonations in popular culture, and it's sort of the end of the world kind of thing. But on a battlefield, which is pretty large, using 10 kiloton nuclear device, the area effect isn't that great. And against military targets that are on the move and somewhat hardened, again, more limited. So before the invasion of Ukraine, Russia had a lot of tactical nuclear weapons, and there was talk that they had this idea of escalate to de-escalate, right? We're losing a conventional war, so we will detonate a dozen or a handful of tactical nuclear weapons to show how serious we are. And ultimately, what I think the history of Ukraine proves is that that would show how serious they're not. Because if they use enough to make a significant difference on the battlefield, they'd be using so much or attacking a strategic area in the rear or killing so many civilians, that escalation control is totally, you can't count on it. But if you use a small number of weapons, then you haven't really done that much damage, and you've shown that you're not serious. And
No, no, no. Well, I was thinking. I mean, I wanted to pull on what you know, that I spent the first 10 years, the last 10 years of the Cold War in tactical nuclear weapons.
Right.
And I was deployed to Korea, but other places. And the bottom line is we absolutely intended and practiced and planned, because it was in war plans, to use tactical nuclear weapons as not as a form of escalate to de-escalate, but literally just as
war fighting.
As war fighting. That's exactly right. I mean, I could talk more, but I'll just leave it there. And so, has that approach behind us? That countries aren't going to Russia in Ukraine, that it wouldn't use that type of tactic to employ nuclear weapons, tactical nuclear weapons, so that it could just be more effective of what it's trying to do, kill people and achieve its objectives?
So the American tactical nuclear arsenal during the Cold War, and I should make a distinction here or a definitional explanation, a tactical nuclear weapon is largely just a term we use for weapons that are not strategic, and they're not strategic in the sense that they're not delivered by an intercontinental weapons platform, and that came out of arms control negotiations, right? So I was on a START inspection team at my first base in Cheyenne, Wyoming. The Russian team came out to inspect our Peacekeeper weapon system, and they were, the treaty allows you to focus on the delivery system. An ICBM is big, a nuclear weapon is not. And so it was all about that. So strategic weapons are tied to a bomber or a submarine or an ICBM. The yield we tend to think of as tactical or strategic, but really any nuclear weapon is strategic, and yield doesn't have to do with tactical. So when we talk about tactical weapons, we're just talking about things that are short range, deliverable that way. And your units in the 80s were not going to launch an attack on Russia. They were going to use those weapons in the face of a major Soviet breakout through the Fulda Gap. So by this time, the war has escalated pretty dramatically compared to what we're looking at in Ukraine right now, where that escalation has not really happened in that way between the Russians and the West. Between the Russians and Ukraine, yes. So I find it a little bit confusing and hard to predict, but that's my best assessment.
So I said I wanted to pull you through onto this other side of what you're talking about, which was avoiding this new arms race. And so you laid it out well. So let me just ask you this question. How should the U.S. then respond to China's nuclear growth without triggering unnecessary escalation?
Number one, we have to start talking.
Okay.
Right? I mean, we just don't have enough channels of communication right now, and that needs to happen at the track two level, which is a limited amount of that happening. It needs to happen at the track one level as well. And that's really the first most important thing I would stress right now. The second thing is the Chinese must always be the Chinese must always be certain that we can respond with devastating second strike capabilities should they launch on us first. And the third thing that we really need to do is try to reduce the risk of international crises and flashpoints. And that's not an easy thing to do. What I will tell you about the Cuban Missile Crisis, what the Cuban Missile Crisis did was it really focused in the minds of leaders in Moscow and Washington that we can't allow ourselves to get this close to a conflict ever again. And that lesson, I think, held very strongly through the rest of the Cold War. We never allowed ourselves to get to that point. We haven't learned that lesson yet with China, and I hope we can learn it without going through another near miss like the Cuban Missile Crisis, because you can only get lucky so many times.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. Let's talk about the role of alliances in all of this. So the U.S., it strengthens its partnerships with AUKUS, Australia, UK, and the United States, with the Quad, and it does this in response to the regional threats. And so if you're China, how does all this contribute to deterrence, and do they perhaps see this as provoking?
They definitely see it as provoking. I'm not a Chinese scholar per se. I don't speak Mandarin, but I read a lot about their strategic view on things. And it's not ideal, but they believe Taiwan is part of China. And so our efforts to deter them from reunifying, as they call it, is definitely seen as provocative. But I'm reminded of a statement from Kissinger when we first negotiated with Beijing and then ended up switching our recognition to China over Taiwan. And on the issue of Taiwan, our colleague Matt Kent brought out this quote last week that there was no misunderstanding. Kissinger and Mao perfectly understood each other's positions. They just didn't agree. And therefore, they needed to find a way to navigate through that space, even though they didn't agree. The simplest formulation of that for us that I can see is former PACOM commander who said, what we need to do is pursue U.S. military capabilities as well as partnerships and allies working together such that every day Xi Jinping wakes up and says, not today.
Okay, so there's so many things I want to bring up. I think I want to pull back a little bit on this managing of crisis communications. I alluded throughout this of the Cold War, we had direct communication channels, and this was these are nuclear rivals, and those who remember the Cold War remember how this just everything was seen through this prism of real stark enemies on either side, and yet we sat down and negotiated treaties. I spoke about that. We had communication channels that went forward, and as you've noted, these things are lacking right now with China, and China has the capability to continue to expand on all of this. And so I think I'm going to pull on what you've talked about and ask you, the hard question. So what do we do? We're not doing it. We're not talking. So, and you talked about alliances and how these things are trying to build up size and have. What can we do differently? What would you suggest that would reduce this risk of miscalculation or accidental escalations?
Well, as far as I understand it, right now the Chinese are reluctant to talk to us. So there's a limit to how much we can do other than to continue to encourage them that we do want to talk. Mm. With the Soviet Union and the Russians after the Cold War, one avenue of conversation that proved productive was scientist-to-scientist discussions. So there was a lot of cooperation, particularly after the Cold War, where scientists were visiting each other. There's an example of that with North Korea. You're familiar with Dr. Sig Hecker, former director of Los Alamos National Labs, made, I think, 11 trips to North Korea, including 8 to the nuclear complex at Yongbyon. And so that kind of dialogue can be very beneficial. So maybe that's a place to start.
I actually like that a lot. Frankly, we actually see that type of engagement actually does lead to more sustained and broadened engagement. As we're running a little bit low, let me ask one more question, and that this is on the future of U.S. deterrence. So as the nuclear landscape in the Indo-Pacific continues to evolve, and it is evolving, and U.S. policy faces new challenges and choices, and there are plenty that are coming before us, what should be the top priorities for U.S. nuclear strategy in the coming decades? What should we be doing, the U.S. strategy?
Well, I'll offer a couple of thoughts on that. I had thought about this before, but as our conversation has evolved, some new thoughts have popped up. Obviously, we've already talked about the importance of second strike. And so one of the things we're facing right now is the expense of recapitalizing our nuclear delivery forces, right? The Minuteman III's came into service in the 60s. They've been, you know, upgraded a little bit and revitalized and maintained very well. But it's getting more and more expensive to maintain them. So we have a new program called Sentinel, which is billions and billions of dollars over budget. And that's unfortunate, but we need to continue to recapitalize. We need to do the same thing for the Columbia submarines. We need to do the same thing for the bombers. The B-21 is actually on pretty good, within budget, I think, which is unusual. We have to think carefully about how AI and computer technology affects command and control today. There's an interesting incentive to use more AI because AI can recognize patterns quicker than we can. The problem is we don't really understand why it's recognizing the patterns, and sometimes it will see a pattern that is incorrect. So, you know, there's going to be a temptation to sort of more tightly integrate AI into our strategic communication and strategic decision making with regard to this. I think we have to be extremely careful about how we do that. A couple of years ago, there was a news story about one of our old missile complexes, and they were making a joke how they were still using 8.5-inch floppy disks as if that was a bad thing. I'm like, well, that's really a good thing, because now I know it's not connected to the internet. So we really have to focus on that, and I'm sure that dialogue is happening in classification levels I don't have access to, because it has to, right? So, but we do need to be mindful of that. And that's where another thing I think that our strategy needs to be very clear-eyed about. You make mistakes when you're scared. You make mistakes when you're anxious. And as I mentioned earlier, there was an article recently about the Chinese buildup is actually more advanced than we think, as if that's an alarming thing. And we need to be confident in ourselves. We do have a secure second strike capability right now. There is no question. Those systems are old, but they still work. And as long as we continue to, you know, maintain that capability, we have, you know, security from a surprise attack.
We've got quite a few audience questions, and so I'll restrain myself from asking a few of my own at this point. So the first one's asking about China's evolving doctrine. And so do you see signs that China is shifting its declaratory policy? And what would that mean for the strategic stability in the Indo-Pacific? Go ahead. I was going to say, some of these questions may give you an opportunity to pull deeper on some of your thoughts that you have done before.
I think we have to, let me rephrase that. We would be wise to look at the Chinese expansion of their nuclear arsenal as a potential change in posture, or not posture, change in strategy, change in policy to move toward launch on warning. They have increased their early warning capabilities, and these new systems give them rapid response. And so we should respond to that not in an alarmed way, like, oh my God, China, it's totally illegitimate for you to do that, right? Because we do that. Right. And we've been doing it for decades during the Cold War. It's not an illogical move. So as we look at the Chinese continue to expand their arsenal, rather than be alarmed and resentful that they're doing this, we should try to ensure that they recognize two things. We don't want a nuclear war, But if they start one, they're not walking away. Does that make sense?
It does. No, it does. And I kind of mentioned that directly in my opening about we can't win a war, neither can we survive one. And that they ought to walk away with understanding that. This next question is asking more about tactical nukes and Taiwan in this case. And so how likely is it that China would consider using tactical nuclear weapons in a conflict over Taiwan?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. My short answer would be unlikely. They don't really need to. They have what are called carrier killer intermediate range ballistic missiles with a conventional warhead. They have enough of them to sink a carrier. They don't really need tactical nuclear weapons to do that. Ironically, the U.S. might be more incentivized to use tactical nuclear weapons on a beachhead that the Chinese might establish in Taiwan. I've seen some people writing about that, where that might be a time where the U.S. could use one. It wouldn't be too destructive to the Chinese to maybe invoke their nuclear response, but it would be effective on a beachhead, because again, you've got a small area where that weapon can make an effect. But I don't really see a great appeal for the Chinese to do that going forward. But the question is, aside from nuclear weapons, a lot of times people, say, well, our carriers are vulnerable to Chinese missiles, and that's really bad, and it is really bad, but it's also a really big decision for the Chinese to make. If the Chinese sink a U.S. aircraft carrier, they've just killed almost 3,000 Americans and taken out, one of the most prestigious sources of national power we have. They don't need a nuclear weapon to do that, but if they do it, then what's the United States response going to be? And I can tell you that in 1941, 3,000 Americans died in Pearl Harbor, and in 2001, just under 3,000 people died in New York City and Washington, D.C., and we saw the U.S. response to that. So if I was a Chinese decision maker, I would be very hesitant to sink U.S. aircraft carrier unless I was sure that the stakes were so high that we had to just go all out.
Yeah, and I think war games that have been done on this various scenario has shown actually more than one aircraft carrier being sunk in these fights. And so these are really dangerous prospects that we speak about.
Well, and, as an Air Force guy for a long time, I've felt carriers are pretty vulnerable, right? Because just the way the technology has evolved, they have to get too close, and they're just big targets, and missiles have gotten better and more maneuverable and things like that. But they have been a great projection platform for the United States for a long time against non-peer competitors. In a Taiwan Strait scenario, it's not a non-peer competitor, but that does highlight the importance of U.S. allies and partners. So those carriers will be, vulnerable and probably taken out, or maybe not even committed to the fight.
Probably not committed.
But in our partners and allies, Japan, Korea, the Philippines, we have unsinkable carriers, right? And so it speaks more clearly. It shows very clearly how important those partnerships are.
Well, let's pull now on this next question. That's going to talk a little bit about partners. This is talking about Japan and South Korea's calculus, but it's asking it: to what extent might China's nuclear expansion push Japan or South Korea to consider developing their own nuclear deterrence?
Yeah, that's a great question. So ultimately, for a long time, we've had a nuclear umbrella.
Yes.
Extended deterrence for our allies that don't have nuclear weapons. And, periodically during the Cold War, questions were asked, like, how credible is this, right? Like, would we sacrifice American cities to defend European cities or Asian cities, partners and allies? And I think that is a really interesting question. In my dissertation, I looked at a number of crises that involved extended deterrence, and what I inferred from the data that I analyzed was that extended deterrence could be counted on to work in situations where there were significant numbers of Americans in that country, in that place, right? Yeah. And so from that perspective, Japan and South Korea should be very confident, because we have not only tens of thousands of soldiers on the ground, but hundreds of thousands of civilians on the ground. And so any significant attack on those partners would kill many, many Americans, and therefore, I think, lead to U.S. intervention and movement into the conflict. That said, if I was advising the Japanese or the Korean government as a scholar, I would say at this point in time, the cost to going nuclear, to acquiring nuclear weapons, exceed the value to your country. Yeah. But that could change in the future, and so you'd probably want to hedge a little bit by maintaining the technological capability to move in that direction quickly if things changed.
Yeah, without a doubt, those countries and others are thinking about, you know, about their latent nuclear capability. They also, without a doubt, must think about the path that North Korea took when it abrogated the Non-Proliferation Treaty by, you know, declaring national interest according to Article 10 of the treaty, and then submitting their withdrawal to the UN, and so through the IAEA, and so it was rough, and they still have those issues, and so one often wonders if economically it won't be quite burdensome for them to go in those directions. I think that is the intent to try to keep countries from going that way. This next question is asking about the triangular deterrence with Russia and China. So how does the emergence of trilateral nuclear dynamics, and you spoke about that a little bit earlier, between the U.S., China, and Russia, how does that change how we might think about deterrence and crisis management?
Yeah, so it, as I said, it introduces more uncertainty in the equation, which I think highlights the need for more communication so that we can lower that uncertainty as much as we can. The good news is, although China and Russia are partners and have an eternal friendship or
yes,
some term, you know, marrying up nuclear command and control and nuclear war plans is probably never going to happen because it's just so fundamentally tied to national survival that it's really hard to do. The United States, during the Cold War, we had a nuclear umbrella in NATO, and the British and the French pursued their own nuclear weapons programs, and the French really never integrated into the NATO plan because they just didn't want to be vulnerable, at least from their perspective, to that. And I think that the Chinese and the Russians are probably in that same boat. They won't integrate their plans. They'll talk, and that's fine, and we should talk. In terms of numbers, this is another interesting question with relation to numbers, right? Right now, Russia and the United States have roughly equivalent numbers of nuclear weapons, and the Chinese arsenal is now growing, getting closer to the United States. So one question that people might ask is, do we need to have as many weapons as both Russia and China combined? And the answer I would say is no. That ends up getting us into an arms race that just can go on forever and be very expensive. What we need is secure second strike capability. And if as long as we have secure second strike capability, we've got enough. I think we probably also want to say that we don't want either of those two countries to have significantly more weapons than we do. Just out of an abundance of caution. But if we communicate to the Chinese and the Russians, hey, we're not going to try and stay twice as many weapons as you guys have, but you're never going to get significantly ahead of us, then maybe we can avoid that kind of an arms race.
Well, then let's pull on that. This next question is asking about arms control prospects. So do you see a realistic pathway for a nuclear arms control agreement between the U.S. and China?
That's a great question. So In the field of arms control, I think there's a reasonable debate about whether arms control creates trust or arms control follows trust. I tend to lean a bit more on the arms control follows trust than it creates trust, although it can help. I will say my personal experience when I was at F.E. Warren in 1994 and that Russian START inspection team came out, I developed a little bit of trust with the START inspectors, the Russians that came
out. Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty.
Right, Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty that we negotiated in the 1990s, and we reduced the number of weapons, and the Soviets and the Russians reduced the number of weapons as well. Then we went to START II, then we went to New START. Now we don't have any of that, but at the time, that was funny. I have this picture back somewhere in my house where the 10-person Russian team came in, and our 10-person American team there, and we're all in a group photo, and everybody looks stern and mean, and I'm sure they're all KGB, and they're sure we're all CIA. And after 3 days or 4 days of this inspection, I'm pretty sure that guy is KGB, but most of them are just Rocket Forces guys, and we developed a little bit of trust there. So in terms of arms control in Asia, years ago, Russian fellows attending APCSS events were asking me, Bill, how can we bring China into arms control, nuclear arms control? Because the Russians at that time were interested in it. And ultimately, the Chinese had made very clear, until we're equal, we're not interested. So from the Chinese, from what they have said, as their arsenal approaches ours in 2030 or maybe before, they theoretically will be open to arms control. But I wouldn't put too much emphasis in getting an actual treaty because that's so hard to do. We can work toward that. That's not a bad goal, but more important than a treaty is stability and communication.
Well said. This next question is asking about no first use policy. And so would it enhance deterrence for the United States to abandon its informal assurance of no first use of nuclear weapons?
I've long been a believer that no first use pledges are meaningless. When push comes to shove in a crisis, if you think your national interests require you to use nuclear weapons, you're not going to stop because the president before you, or even your own presidency 6 months ago, said we're not going to use nuclear weapons first. I think no first use pledges in an environment where they're believable can elevate a little bit of trust. But if we try to use no first use when it's not really believable, then it undermines trust. So the United States does not have a no first use policy. We've never had a no first use policy. We're a little bit ambiguous about what might cause us to use nuclear weapons first. The Chinese have a no first use policy, but do I believe it? No. And they're moving away from it. The Russians had a no first use policy. Did I believe it? No. I don't think you really can. So I think the key is to build stability, to build trust, to communicate. And if you're making promises that are clearly not likely to be honored, then you're not going to be building trust, right? 15 years ago, before the Chinese nuclear buildup, a Chinese general told me at an event that their nuclear posture clearly indicated that they were no first use. Didn't matter what they said, but they were postured in a way not to use nuclear weapons first, which is true at that time. They had liquid-fueled ICBMs, probably warheads not mated, and it would take them a little while to do that. So that posture suggested no first use. U.S. posture does not suggest no first use.
Yeah, I understand what you're talking about on posture, but I'm not sure everybody listening does, that if, you know, your deployed weapons and whether they're mated and whether they're fueled and they're ready to be able to be employed, that signals a policy which is not limited by no first use.
Right.
Yeah, and if you've got it, you got to get all the stuff together and pull it together. You know, you obviously have signaled something different. And
right. So, you know, there's a long debate about the value of kind of the United States kind of moving away from this sort of very elevated alert posture, which we've had basically forever. Yeah. And it's an interesting philosophical debate. I don't know where I fall down on this, because some people say that would be great because it would reduce the risk of miscalculation in a crisis. Other people say it would make the crisis more dangerous, because at some point you'd have to decide, oh, things have gotten significantly scary. We need to start getting our alert posture higher, which then could create the very dynamic you're trying to avoid.
I think we'll take one more question. And so this one's asking about rational actor assumptions. And so much of the deterrence theory depends on the idea of rational actors. And so do you see this as a reliable assumption when it comes to China?
Yes, I do. I think, you know, human beings in general are pretty rational most of the time, maybe. But if you're the leader of, you know, an advanced industrial country, you had to make a lot of rational decisions to get there. So I don't worry about the leader of China being irrational. I do worry about the leader of any country being surrounded by yes people who tell them things they want to hear, right? Like Russia probably would not have invaded Ukraine if people told Vladimir Putin, you're going to lose 167,000 troops, right? They probably told him it would take 3 days, pack your parade uniform. In our own country, a lot of people were advising President Bush, G.W. Bush, that, you know, Iraq would be a pushover and we would be fine. And then we found that that wasn't the case. And I wonder if President Bush at that time in 2001 would have said, oh, you know, this is going to be too costly, we can't do this, right? But General Shinseki was fired, essentially, for
saying, Army Chief of Staff.
Yeah, so he was fired for suggesting that this would require a lot more force. So clearly that administration didn't want to hear that argument. So that, rather than rationality, strictly speaking, I worry about, you know, bad information at the highest levels, which again gets back to talking. If Xi Jinping and President Trump are talking, then they're less vulnerable to their advisors telling them what they want to hear, because they're hearing it direct, right? When President Trump met with North Korean President Kim Jong-un, many thought, oh, this is a bad idea. We were giving the North Koreans credibility, and I thought, there is that cost, but having that direct dialogue has value. It ultimately didn't pan out the way you and I had hoped. We've talked a lot about that.
Yeah. But,
so I think the rational model can still be relied on. Another example from the Cuban Missile Crisis, I think, is relevant here. At the height of the crisis, there were senior people in both Moscow and Washington who were strongly pushing for actions that they should have realized were too dangerous. But they were pushing anyway. An attack on Cuba, an attack on the United States fleet, that submarine I mentioned earlier. Both Kennedy and Khrushchev, however, clearly are not willing to go down that path. So the question that we haven't been able to answer since then, because we haven't had a similar crisis, is were Kennedy and Khrushchev unusual? Or is that the thing you're going to get in the leader of such an event? You know, once you get to that position, you can't afford to take the risks that some of your underlings may encourage you to take. Does that make sense?
It does.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to ask you for a book recommendation, but I think I just might note that you know, you and I have worked together on a lot of things, including you've been writing for me on these books that we're putting out. And we've got two books coming out. We've got, and this is in the Strategic Edge series. And so The Edge of Competition, you've got a reissue of this book. It'll be this chapter, which will be on China's nuclear rise. Mm-hmm. And then you're working on a collaborative one on nuclear Indo-Pacific.
Right.
And so a much broader look at that. And that's coming out at the beginning of the year. And so I know you are deep in this topic, and we're really grateful with that. Maybe you might recommend to the audience somebody else that you've read and think that they would value from reading as well.
Yeah, so there's a lot of potential candidates for this,
and I
don't mean to say any of the ones I didn't choose are not as good, but I think really interesting, people don't know this fellow very well, but his name is Fred Kaplan. This book came out in 2020. It's about the history of, you know, U.S. decision-making with regard to nuclear strategy, et cetera. Fred had also written a book in the 80s called Wizards of Armageddon, which really focuses on the early era of nuclear strategy development. Both are excellent and well worth reading and have sort of anecdotes and stories and insights that you don't really see normally. And it's pretty good reading. It's not dry.
Well, thank you for that recommendation. Thank you for being here. I look forward to having you back here as a guest on another topic soon as well. You certainly have a long list of things that you could talk about, and you and I have talked about it at length. And so thanks for this hour together.
Thank you.
Yeah,
great.
Absolutely.
As we conclude today's dialogue, it's clear that China's nuclear rise presents a complex and evolving challenge. Understanding the nuances of this issue is crucial for shaping effective security strategies in the Indo-Pacific and beyond. These conversations shape security. Join us again for another important episode. And on behalf of all of us at DKIE PCSS, thank you for being part of this important conversation. I'm James Minnick, and until we meet again, aloha oi. As always, the opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKIE PCSS, the U.S. Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.